Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly legislative podcast. I'm John Pimble.
Before we open it up to other questions, I would like to address an issue.
Governor Kim Reynolds holds a weekly press conference on Monday mornings. Over the weekend, the governor fired the director of Iowa Finance Authority, Dave Jamieson.
On Friday evening, my office was made aware of credible allegations of sexual harassment by former Director Jamieson. Upon learning this, I terminated his employment effective immediately. I can tell you that these complaints were made by the victim directly to a member of my staff on Friday evening. The victims had not made a complaint internally at the Iowa Finance Authority. They came straight to my office. I can also tell you that the allegations were made solely against Director Jamieson. There were no complaints against any other Iowa Finance Authority employee. I know you probably have additional questions, but for the victims of sexual harassment, coming forward is a hard thing to do. It takes courage. So at the request of the victims, and to protect their privacy and their identity, there is only so much that I can say about the details of the allegations.
In recent months, much attention has been given to sexual harassment in state government after a former Senate staffer sued and was awarded a settlement. In response last November, an internal report was created by the Senate. At the time, Governor Reynolds said Senate Republicans should release additional information the report may have uncovered. She also said in November it was important to be cognizant of personal information, but encouraged the release of more facts while protecting personal information. This week, she is asked how not releasing additional information about accusations of sexual harassment surrounding Dave Jamieson is different.
Because this is about the victims. This is about victims that came to me and identified sexual harassment, and they ask it to be remain confidential. So this is hard, and it takes a lot of courage to do this. And I want to make sure that every employee knows that this is a safe environment. It is an expectation of this administration that there will be zero tolerance, and I want them to feel comfortable going to the person that they need to file that complaint. So it's not about the story, it's about the individual, and to make sure that they feel comfortable and confident in exposing what they have been exposed to.
Given the confidentiality that you're talking about, are you able to tell us whether there have been any other complaints against Mr. Jamieson in the past?
Not that I'm aware of.
You didn't find out about this till Friday night. How were you able to terminate him so quickly?
I found out about it on Friday, and we took action on Saturday.
And how did it happen so fast?
Well, listen, the allegations were against a director. He is an at-will employee, and so I took action on Saturday.
So there's no, you know, it's just not a lot of fact-finding or researching or whatever, so.
He's an at-will employee. It was a director. I have a zero tolerance policy. I've made that extremely clear. I requested everybody retake the sexual harassment training, which helps individuals identify what that entails. It makes it very clear in the training and who you can go to respond. And so the expectations were extremely clear.
As to how this was reported, the governor says the victims talked to her chief of staff last Friday night, March 23rd. He then made the governor aware of what she calls credible allegations.
I asked that everybody meet Saturday morning. I met with the chief of staff, my senior legal counsel, Janet Phipps, and David Roeder. And I took action by the afternoon.
Governor, did Director Jamieson complete the
It is my understanding that everybody in the office had completed that. And I ask the directors to notify our office when it has been complete.
The governor says she hopes her quick action sends a strong message.
I said in my condition of the state, I've said over and over, I have a zero tolerance policy. I can't legislate morality. I can't pass a law that says everybody treats everybody with respect, but I can lead and I can set an expectation, and that's what I did. I heard about it and I took action, and that should let every employee know that if they are experiencing this, that it won't be tolerated, and they have a safe place to go to file that complaint. And if they do, they will be heard and action will be taken. And that's what happened. That simple. Friday night, Saturday morning we met, we walked through the process, and he was terminated Saturday afternoon.
Governor, beyond being professional colleagues for a long time, you and Mr. Jamison have been friends for years, have you not? I mean, do you see this as a personal betrayal?
This isn't about me. This is about the victims. This is about the individuals that came forward to talk about a difficult situation that they had been put in. So it's about the victims. So again, we can go over and over about details and what you expect, but the bottom line is, what I expect is I expect the employees of the state of Iowa to feel comfortable and confident that if they come to me in confidence with what they are saying they are experiencing in sexual harassment, that they will be heard and action will be taken.
Iowa Democratic Party officials have concerns about the governor's firing of Jamison without a formal complaint or an official inquisition. They say this is a departure from how she approached sexual harassment among her political allies. The Democrats have filed a Freedom of Information Act request per the Iowa Open Records Law. They want the hiring records of Jamison, his personnel file, emails between the governor's office and the Iowa Finance Authority regarding harassment going back to May 2017, the governor's schedules, call logs, and emails for March 23rd through March 24th, which is Friday and Saturday when these recent events occurred. It's not unusual for the Iowa Democratic Party to present a Freedom of Information Act request to this administration. The governor's office has 20 days to respond as to whether they will provide or deny all or part of the information request. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the legislative session. I'm John Pimble. It is an election year for every seat in the House, half the seats in the Senate, and the governor. A primary in June will whittle down the number of candidates. 2 weeks ago, everyone who wants to run as a Democrat, Republican, or Libertarian had to file their nomination petitions with the Secretary of State. Then, a one-week period follows where anyone can make an objection to any candidate if they can prove there is a problem with their petitions. This week, a state objection panel heard challenges against seven candidates, a number Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate says is high.
This has been a really unusual year for nominating petitions. This is my second time as Secretary of State, and I've never seen this many issues come up like this.
At the Capitol, Pate is part of the three-member state objection panel to determine if the challenges are to be accepted or rejected. He is joined by State Auditor Mary Mosman and Attorney General Tom Miller. One challenge is for House District 56 for Alan McKee in Clayton County. The seat is open after Republican Representative Christy Hager decided she would only serve one term. No other Republican has stepped forward. Since a Republican has not entered the field, the party can put a person on the ballot through a state convention this summer. This is where Dale Bolsinger comes into the picture from Colesburg. He started collecting signatures 2 days before the deadline. Bolsinger turned in his nominating petition on the due date as a Republican, but a member from the Alan McKee County Board of Supervisors, Ann Amason, filed a challenge because she says he's actually a Democrat. To make the challenge on her behalf at the Capitol is Charlie Smithson, who is also the Secretary of the Iowa Senate. Smithson opens by identifying why he is here.
I'm not representing a government agency here today. In fact, I am taking leave I am here on behalf of Ms. Osmondson, who's asked me in my capacity as being around elections for 20-some years.
Smithson says when Bolsinger was collecting signatures for his petition to run as a Republican, he was registered as a Democrat.
This is an issue that is not substantial compliance. The fact that signatures were collected and filed on behalf of one party, when in fact the individual was of another party, tears at the very fabric of what primary elections are for, which is for parties to be able to choose their own candidates.
Smithson says if this type of activity becomes a precedent, it will be a problem for Republicans, Democrats, and Libertarians.
This will be the type of campaigning that happens in future elections. All three recognized parties would be smart to just find somebody, collect signatures, file, and potentially block the convention holding after the nomination petition, other avenues that are available.
Dale Bolsinger did register in his county as a Republican during the noon hour, March 16th, the day the nomination papers were due in Des Moines at the Secretary of State's office. Bolsinger joins the panel by phone to defend his candidacy as a Republican. He says he was able to collect signatures running for the Republican ballot first, then change his party affiliation.
So the Iowa Code requires that I state the political party with which I'm registered on an affidavit of candidacy. I believe that's code section 4318 right in front of you. And on the nominating papers, the code says nothing about the order of changing the party affiliation and collecting signatures. If there was an issue with that, that's pertaining to the Iowa Code section. At the time, they want to say that I filed an affidavit of candidacy, that I was registered as a member of the Iowa Democratic Party. I'll explain this. This is an inaccurate statement as well. The submitted and accepted voter registration form was on 3/16 at 12:42 p.m. I am a registered member of the Republican Party of Iowa. My affidavit of candidacy was submitted to the Iowa Secretary of State at 4:23 p.m. I have submitted my voter registration as accepted and timestamped by the Clayton County Auditor. And my affidavit of candidacy as accepted and timestamped by the Iowa Secretary of State's office. So maybe I don't fit the mustard for some of these folks. There's a lot of values that I have with the Republican Party. I don't like the direction the state's going. And I signed up because there was nobody on the ballot. And there's a lot that I agree with that party. I changed my voter registration lawfully, legally, and I want to run to represent the people of my district. And I don't appreciate me having to take time off from work to explain all of this.
Charlie Smithson says Bolsinger's actions border on being fraudulent.
When the signatures were collected on the nomination petitions, he was registered as a Democrat, saying he was registered or he's going to run as a Republican. Code's very clear. This type of potential almost voter fraud should not be permitted in this state. And this panel has ruled before that this type of issue is very central to what your decision making is. We do not believe this is substantial compliance at all.
Bolsinger says he told those signing the petition he was running as a Republican, and again argues the Iowa Code says nothing about the order of changing party affiliation after signatures are collected.
When it comes to a political party's agenda, you should be able to follow that and have a lot in common with it before registering to vote. If there was something put in place to say you had to be a Democrat, Republican, officially registered for this many years or this many months, we would have an argument on our hands. But the reality is both parties are changing drastically. And as they change, sometimes you go with another party, even though you might not be registered. So when I found out that they weren't putting anybody up as a Republican that shares a lot of values with me, I decided to put myself on the ballot, and I followed the code sections doing so. So just because there might be somebody over there that doesn't want to see Dale on the ballot, this isn't the way to go about it. We have laws, and I follow them, and I don't think this is fair. And that's all I've got to say.
Secretary of State Paul Pate has concerns Bolsinger didn't change his voter registration until after he collected signatures.
It would have been much easier if he had changed his voter registration prior to going out and circulating the nomination paper as that part.
And Mr. Pate?
Yes.
Yes, sir. I don't know if I'm out of line by speaking. I'm sorry, but had that been the way the code section was explained and written, maybe that would have been the case.
Okay.
I've had a lot of issues with the Democratic Party for a long time now.
As the panel makes its decision, Mary Mosman says this candidate should have changed his party registration before getting signatures.
I'm just going to go with the point of law, and the petitions were circulated on March 15th, and the voter registration was changed March 16th, so I'm going to just again follow the law. And what's the word? Reject then the challenge? Or approve the challenge?
Mr. Bolsinger, did you hear that?
Oh, sorry.
No, I didn't.
They're asking for him to be declined, so either you're denying the
I'm going to accept,
it means voluntarily denying means.
I'm going to accept the challengers just to follow the point of law being when the individual signed the petitions, he was a registered Democrat, and then he switched the day later to a registered Republican. So just as I read the law, trying to follow the intent of the law.
Did you want to jump in?
Then a motion.
No. Anything else?
A second. I'll second. I did the motion on the table, the discussion.
Anything else?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. All right. I'm sorry, sir. We'll send you a letter, but fortunately it didn't work out for you.
Bolsinger is removed from the ballot for House District 56. There are a certain number of signatures each person must gather to get on the ballot. That number varies according to the office. For the governor's race, the number of signatures Republican gubernatorial candidate Ron Corbett needs is 4,005. Corbett is the former speaker of the Iowa House and, more recently, the former mayor of Cedar Rapids. He wants to run against Governor Reynolds in the June primary. He turned in his nomination petitions within an hour of the deadline with 4,091 signatures. The next week, his petitions are challenged by Craig Robinson, a longtime Republican activist. Robinson analyzed Corbett's petitions and discovered duplicate signatures, something that is common with petitions. But because Corbett only exceeded the number of signatures by 86, eliminating the duplicates brings his campaign below the required threshold of 4,005. The Secretary of State encourages all candidates to exceed the required number by a large margin to avoid close calls like this. Representing Robertson in front of the state objection panel is Attorney Matt Dummermuth.
Our research, my client's research, shows that there are at least 102 invalid duplicates. And there are at least 6 signatures that are invalid because the wrong county is listed.
Dummermuth reads from the code, stating if there are problems with a petition once it is turned in, a candidate can make revisions as long as it is before the deadline.
We don't believe it's unfair to enforce the ballot access requirements in this case. There was ample prior warning. As the Secretary of State has already referred to, the candidate guide that all candidates had for the primary election. The Corbett campaign was a candidate for almost a year, been a prior successful candidate more than once, and has paid campaign staffers to assist, in addition to volunteers.
This challenge lasts for 2 hours. Signatures in question are discussed. Some are declared to be okay. But in the end, there are 8 in question. They are signatures the campaign struck out with a single line through it to remove them from the petition because they were concerned about the town and county listed not correctly correlating. Attorney for the Corbett campaign, Pat Seeley, explains why the names were crossed off.
And I can tell you in Sioux City, we're on the northern border of Woodbury County, and we have plenty of people who have a Sioux City address but live in Plymouth County and not Woodbury. And so these individuals here, we crossed them out because we believed they were in the wrong county. We believed that these addresses were not for the county that is listed. We now have gone back and looked at those individuals, and I believe if you look, there are 7 altogether. There should be 7 highlights altogether. We now believe those individuals, all 7 of them, are correct, and we should not have crossed them out. It was our mistake just trying to comply with the guidelines.
The Corbett campaign depends on Seeley successfully arguing these crossed-off names should be included in the count. But attorney Matt Dummermuth disagrees.
I think it would be fair to say that the practice of the Secretary of State's office, but you know better than we do, is that any signatures crossed off are not submitted by the campaign. That's their admission that these shouldn't count. And I don't think you can resubmit them after the deadline passes.
Seeley admits it was a mistake, but he fights for these names to be counted.
We made a mistake in correcting something that never needed correcting. It's all 100% accurate as it appears on this form. The only thing that's not accurate was our mistake in crossing off something that was accurate.
Panelist Mary Mosman doesn't see how the signatures that have been crossed off can be counted.
I don't see how I interpret this as not adding a signature back in after the petitions have been submitted. I'm not understanding how it's anything other than that.
Paul Pate agrees.
You know, when a name is struck off and they are submitted to us, we take that as that's not a name on there. It's gone. And we can't be a mind reader as to what that was about. We have to take it at face value. And now we're here.
But Attorney General Tom Miller is not so sure.
I'm very torn, to be truthful. In the sense that this is a really serious matter.
Mm-hmm.
The governor's race is by far the most important race in our state. The chief executive has just enormous power. And Ron Corbett is a very substantial candidate for this office. And we are sort of teetering on whether he has enough signatures when there's a requirement of 4,005 signatures.
Corbett's attorney Pat Seeley makes one more plea to count the 8 signatures the campaign crossed off.
If those 8 votes are counted, these are legitimate electors that did nothing wrong. Did nothing wrong. We were the ones that crossed them out. And we are making a decision for the highest position in this state to say that these 3 people are going to decide for the voters of the state of Iowa and not allow them to choose when everything that they did was absolutely correct.
Before making a final decision, the panel adds the numbers again.
We have verified that the new number is 3,997.
Which is 8 short of 4,005. The panel makes a final vote, but Secretary of State Pate and State Auditor Mosman are confused about the correct wording for the motion.
At this point, those in favor of the petition, to sustain the petition, say aye. I'm sorry. Thank you for clarifying that. It would get me in big trouble. Aye.
Voting in favor of sustaining
the petition.
Sustaining
the objection. You can see there's no cue cards, no teleprompter, and no. All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
All right, motion carries.
It's a 2-1 vote, with Tom Miller voting no. Ron Corbett has been watching this panel, but during a break talks with reporters. Corbett says he is disappointed.
Today we really thought we had the appropriate number of signatures, but they took a hard line on a couple of the decisions. And I really don't know why Governor Reynolds and her team have worked so hard to get me knocked off the ballot. I think a primary is good. We've had 50 years of governors between Branstad, Vilsack, Culver, Ray, and Branstad and Harold Hughes. They've all had primaries. And I just don't understand why the governor thinks she's entitled to have this nomination without a primary fight. But anyway, it looks like their challenge has been successful, and she will have avoided a primary, unfortunately.
The next day at a press conference in Hiawatha, he says it wouldn't have mattered how many petition signatures he had.
If we filed 150 more, 500 more, 1,000 more, 5,000 more. You see, they've been out to get me since I announced. And they would have found some other tactic, if it wasn't throwing me off the ballot, to knock my campaign.
Corbett is challenging the decision of the panel. He says he expects a judge to make a ruling within a week. If the judge's ruling is against Corbett, he says he will stop his campaign as a Republican. He also says he does not plan to run as an independent candidate. This is Under the Golden Dome from Iowa Public Radio. I'm John Pimble.
Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
A bill designed to impose stiff penalties for infrastructure sabotage passed the Senate last month, and this week it's in the House. The bill also includes the newly functioning Dakota Access Pipeline that delivers oil from North Dakota to Illinois. The path of the pipeline crosses Iowa, and during its construction was the subject of great controversy. Representative Gary Worthen is the floor manager and presents an additional amendment that would cover more utilities than the Senate version.
This critical infrastructure bill started out, with some municipal utilities in the state surfacing the concern that they may not have the protection that they may need for terrorist acts and sabotage on their critical infrastructure. That's where the bill started. It has expanded some. The areas that will be covered now are all electrical power generating transmission delivery systems, gas, oil, petroleum, refined petroleum, renewable fuel, and chemical manufacturing, delivery, and storage systems, telecommunications or broadband generation, wastewater treatment and collection, all those systems, water supply, treatment, collection, and distribution systems, and anything that is attached to those critical infrastructures. This bill would then define critical infrastructure sabotage as having the ability and the intent to cause a major disruption in any of these areas. It creates a Class B felony with a possible prison term of up to 25 years and or a fine of $85,000 to $100,000.
Representative Rick Olson says the one-size-fits-all penalty is a problem.
The court, the county attorney, nor the court, neither of them will be in the position to charge you and potentially convict you of a lesser included offense, something that's not as draconian as a 25-year penalty. Representative Worthen gave an example of anhydrous ammonia out in the country. Well, some young hunter, some 18-year-old with his buddies could be out in that same vicinity of Representative Worthen's anhydrous ammonia, and they decide to take a couple shots at these tanks. And sure enough, they puncture one of the tanks, and the ammonia is released. It's a prank. It's criminal mischief. It's a lot of things, but it isn't some type of breach of critical infrastructure, sabotage in infrastructure in the state of Iowa.
Olson offers an amendment aimed at offering protection for protesters.
And candidly, I'd love to say that it's original language that I came up with, but it's not. It's language that's already found in the Iowa Code under the terrorism section, under 708A1. And what it indicates is that substantial and widespread interruption or impairment of a fundamental service does not mean, should not be construed to prohibit those that would like to picket, those that are engaged in public demonstrations or similar forms of expressing ideas or views regarding legitimate matters of public interest protected by the United States and Iowa constitutions.
Representative Olson's amendment loses. The debate for this bill isn't long, and Olson urges a no vote.
I know that there will be some of you in both parties that feel compelled to vote for this, because if you don't, You're afraid you'll get a card that says you're soft on crime. No, what this is soft on our ability to have free speech.
Representative Worthen says this bill, as amended by the House, is an important tool to protect the state's citizens.
We have a lot of infrastructure out there, whether that be your city water systems or your internet. Primary one everybody thinks about is, of course, the electrical grid. And it's important that we have penalties in place to dissuade people from attacking those systems. That was the concern, the original concern when this bill was brought up, that a Class C criminal mischief or a trespassing charge just didn't provide the protection.
Worthen also says the bill is not an attack on free speech.
The piece that it's an attack on free speech, I believe, is a stretch. We still have options out there for prosecutors, whether that be a Class C criminal mischief or something lesser than that, even an aggravated misdemeanor, get down into the trespass laws and so on. We targeted this at the high end of the offenses, and to an extent, we have to rely on the wisdom of our local prosecutors and local courts.
The bill passes 69-31, which means it has some support from Democrats. It now moves back to the Senate. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislature. I'm John Pimble. The governor signed two bills into law about mental health. One mandates suicide prevention training for school employees. Mary Neubauer is the parent who lost a son to suicide and said this provides a framework for improvement.
Both of these pieces of legislation are significant in terms of just acknowledging the need that exists in Iowa and the huge number of people who need help and in many cases haven't been getting it.
Week 12 of the session just passed us. Projected timeline of the session is 2 or 3 more weeks. I've been getting a lot of help during these 12 shows. Thank you to Joyce Russell, Katerina Sestarik, the talk show team producers Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa is also right there when we need a hand. Katherine Perkins is Iowa Public Radio's news program director. Michael Leland is our news director and gives this show edit support. I can't believe there are a dozen shows already for this year, and if you've missed the other 11, you can get them at iowapublicradio.org, the IPR app, and podcast programs like iTunes. We publish new shows every Friday. Under the Golden Dome is a production of Iowa Public Radio.